Hello, and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising studies and fascinating discoveries of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that in the 1950s, atomic bomb tests were a big, money-making tourism draw for Las Vegas. Soon after the end of World War II, after the U.S. dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, the military began honing the destructive power of these weapons. At first, the U.S. used the Pacific Ocean as its testing grounds, but the variables were too many and too costly. And so it turned to the mainland and Nevada's barren desert. In 1950, with the Cold War escalating hand in hand with the fear of an all-out nuclear attack with Soviet Union, the Nevada test site was created.
It's sort of a backyard workshop, the most unusual scientific workshop in the world. 640 square miles of desert and mountains, 65 miles northwest from Las Vegas, set in some of the loneliest acres the world has ever seen.
The area was ideal for testing. Previously, it had been used as a bombing and gunnery range for Las Vegas, so the facilities were already there. And the predictable desert weather meant that bombs could be unleashed without interruption. Meanwhile, just an hour's drive away, the city of Las Vegas was in the midst of its own boom. Its population had increased by nearly 200% from the 1940s to 1950. It had cornered the market on gambling, and stars like Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Judy Garland, Ella Fitzgerald, and so many more were flooding the newly built casinos for performances. The city was swarming with tourists. By 1954, more than 8 million people would visit Las Vegas in that year alone. But there was one other attraction these tourists were coming to see. In 1951, the Nevada test site detonated its first warhead, more than 1,000 feet off the desert ground. Over in Las Vegas, a few moments after hearing the boom in the distance, a mushroom cloud appeared in the slightly orange-hued sky, hovering there for a serene yet troubling moment. Close enough to be drawn in by its spectacle, but far enough to feel vaguely safe, visitors were mesmerized. And just like that, atomic tourism was born. Tests were typically done once every 3 weeks and in the early morning hours, sometime before dawn. And Las Vegas shamelessly cashed in. The Chamber of Commerce printed up calendars advertising detonation times and the best spots for watching. Restaurants served atomic cocktails, an effervescent mix of vodka, cognac, sherry, and champagne. The Sands Casino held the Miss Atomic Energy Beauty Pageant, and hotels with north-facing vistas would hold Dawn Bomb Parties. Crowds would dance, drink, and schmooze with New Year's Eve verve until 4 in the morning, when the group would turn north and watch that spectacular detonation of a most cruel weapon. Las Vegas's atomic extravaganza came to an end in 1963, when the Limited Test Ban Treaty ended all above-ground nuclear trials following the Cuban Missile Crisis. During that decade plus of atomic tourism, Las Vegas visitors witnessed more than 200 atmospheric tests. The mushroom clouds, the parties, and the atmospheric hangovers may have faded after that, but nuclear testing continued at the Nevada site. Those tests were just moved underground, and the site would come to document 928 atmospheric or underground nuclear tests by the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s. This week I learned that the reason we sleep less as we age has to do with how our brains are wired. When you consider sleep from an evolutionary standpoint, it really doesn't make much sense. When you're asleep, you're basically unconscious, incredibly vulnerable, and terribly unproductive. By these accounts, evolution should have weeded this pesky activity out eons ago. Except that sleep is necessary for our body's survival. In humans, every major organ and regulatory system needs sleep to function properly. And science has suggested recently that not getting enough sleep could actually do you physical harm. Sleeplessness has been associated with a whole host of diseases like heart disease and obesity. One problem here is that as we age, that ability to sleep like a baby, to get that restful night's sleep, declines. And researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, believe that's because our brain doesn't think we're tired anymore. Researchers conducted their study on mice. They compared the chemical signals involved in sleep as they appear in younger mice and as they appear in older mice. What they found was that as the mice aged, their brain lost the neuronal connections that picked up on sleepiness cues. The chemical signature of the sleep cues was the same, but the receptors in the brain that receive those signals faded. In other words, the message was always there, I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired, but your brain loses the ability to hear that message. And the kind of aging that affects your sleep in this way does not start all that late in life. Sleep decline often begins in the late 20s and early 30s, and then just goes on a steady downward slope from there. By the time you're 50, you'll get about half of that deep sleep you had when you were younger. By 70, you can basically kiss it goodbye. You'll wake up constantly throughout the night, never quite achieving those solid Z's. Unfortunately, there's not much we can do about this right now, but researchers are working on it. For now, you can keep up your end of the bargain in achieving a better night's rest, like no caffeine after 1 or 2 in the afternoon. Try sleeping in a room that's slightly colder than what's comfortable, and also exercise consistently, but not within 3 hours of your bedtime. Night night. This week I learned that in the wild, there's a cost to intelligence. A new study published in the journal Scientific Reports looked at bumblebees in particular. Researchers tested the intelligence of 85 foraging bees with 2 artificial flowers, one blue and one yellow. Now, bees prefer blue flowers, but it was the yellow flower that had a sugar reward. Researchers observed how long it took bees to ignore the unrewarding blue flower and go to the yellow one. Once they figured out who were the fast learners and who were the slow learners, these researchers monitored the bees with tracking technology out in the wild. They were looking at their foraging activity and the quality of nectar or pollen they brought back to the nest. And researchers noticed 2 interesting things. One, that the fast-learning bumblebees collected less food than their slower-learning coworkers, and that the fast learners died sooner, too. This, you might imagine, is kind of odd. Enhanced cognitive abilities, like being able to learn fast or being clever, are evolutionarily beneficial to survival, both for the individual and the group, which is why smarts are often associated with improved fitness. So if that's the case, shouldn't these fast-learning bumblebees forage more, not less, than their slower buddies? As it turns out, intelligence is demanding. The brain's neural tissue that makes it work uses great amounts of metabolic energy to produce and maintain itself. Frankly, it's an energy drain that depletes the bees' already limited resources, leaving clever bees with less energy for things like foraging food. Now, I mentioned this evolutionary reason for having advanced cognitive abilities, but it's odd, right, that intelligence seems to impede on a bee's survival, and yet bees continue to have intelligence. Why not just weed out the intelligent bees and have longer living, better foraging dummies? Well, learning is actually really important for bees. They need to learn which flowers provide the most rewards and when and where to find them. So researchers think that the smarter bees may not be helping themselves too much, but they are necessary for the colony's survival. Being able to suss out the most rewarding flowers for the rest of the colony more than makes up for what those nerd bees lack. This week I learned that your cold symptoms can feel worse when you're lonely. Now, feeling lonely and being lonely are two very different things. And a new study published in Health Psychology found that it was those feelings of loneliness, not social isolation, that worsened the experience of having a cold. Researchers from the University of Houston and Rice University recruited 159 healthy 30-year-olds. Then they used viral nasal drops to try to infect them with a cold. About 75% of the group became infected, and the whole of them were quarantined in a hotel for 5 days. Before this began, participants filled out a questionnaire which assessed their subjective sense of loneliness with questions like, how often do you feel left out? Those subjective feelings were checked against an objective measure of how many people they had contact with on a regular basis. From this, researchers would pinpoint who suffered from feelings of loneliness and who didn't. While in the hotel, the volunteers answered a daily set of questions about their cold and the severity of their symptoms. At the end of it, researchers found a few interesting things. First, that simply feeling lonely didn't affect the risk of getting sick in the first place. And also, simply being isolated in their hotel room didn't affect the severity of the cold symptoms. The variable that did change things was whether or not someone felt lonely. The more lonely a person felt, the worse he reported his cold symptoms to be. With this study, researchers suggest that loneliness can be a self-perpetuating negative spiral. With a cold, you feel worse, so you might isolate yourself further, not seeking out comfort or friends to lift your spirits. That lonely people feel worse when they're sick isn't something to be ignored. In fact, knowing this to be true can help with more effective intervention or self-care. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can go to theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find the 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers podcasts. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we at The Week would like to offer you 4 totally free non-commitment issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.